Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The math tells the story on the jobs number. Subtract all the census workers, the labor market barely grew at all last month. Today on the broadcast, things were going pretty well. So how did that happen? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, everybody, the 4th of June. Great to have you with us. And the math goes a little something like this. 431,000 jobs were added to the economy last month. You take away almost all of them, temps for the 2010 census, and what you have is a dispiriting 41,000 net new places to work for the month of May. We're going to take today's report apart with Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Hello, Mitchell.
Hello, Kai.
So let's get straight to the jobs that really count in this report, which would be the permanent private sector jobs, right?
Right. You know, I was getting these exciting emails predicting anything from 170,000 to nearly double that, and that's in addition to the census temps. Well, the census numbers were right, but all the other employers out there, they just sort of didn't show up to the party in May. I mean, the best number in there was 29,000 jobs added in manufacturing. 37,000 were added in services, but actually most of those were temps.
Yeah, which, as we said, doesn't really help. Okay, so let me ask you this then. Does it mean job creation, which we've been enjoying for a couple of months, has stalled, or is it just taking a break?
Well, you have to look at a few months to really see a trend. March and April were actually a good deal better than May. So average it all out, and employers are adding, I don't know, maybe 130,000 private sector jobs a month.
Which doesn't sound so bad if we can keep that up.
Well, you know, actually, it's not really very good. It's just barely enough to keep up with the natural increase in the population. You know, and plus keep in mind, there are about 8 million people who lost jobs in the recession. Of course, a lot of those are looking, and some of them are also now coming back to look again. They may have given up for a while. And that's one reason that unemployment rate, which went down in May, will probably go up again. One person who's right on top of these numbers is Joel Pracken. He's at Macroeconomic Advisors. They're the ones who put out the monthly ADP report that counts private sector jobs.
In a typical sort of recovery from a recession as deep as the one that we've just endured, you would expect to see monthly increases in employment that are measured in hundreds of thousands a month, 300,000, possibly even a little bit more than that for at least a while.
And Pracken explained the reason for that is that employers usually cut back really hard on their most expensive cost, which is labor, when the economy's bad. That's so they don't just go out of business. And then business starts to pick up, and they suddenly have to add people right away, and a fair number of them, just to get ahead of rising sales.
So here's the rub, though. If a regular recession usually leads to strong hiring coming out of it, why isn't this recession, which has been deep and severe and horrible and all those words you can think of, why hasn't that led to much stronger hiring?
Part of it is just that the economy still isn't that strong. There's just so much to worry about. Small businesses can't borrow. The banks are shaky. There's foreclosures. But, you know, there also may be something here about the way that employers are now thinking about labor that's new, about the number of people they actually need. Joel Pracken explains it this way.
Businesses may have cut labor actually far more aggressively than turned out to be necessary. Having cut those employees and discovered they could get by without a lot of them, it may be that you just discovered a one-time increase in efficiency that you're not going to be so quick to undo by hiring workers back too fast.
And we're seeing that in the fact that productivity's way up. Companies are churning out more widgets or websites or whatever per worker. And employers keep adding to people's work week. So people are working harder. They're putting in more overtime. And all of that allows employers to sell more stuff without actually adding jobs.
And so we get reports like today's. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman up at the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Mitchell is working, by the way, on a series about the effects of long-term unemployment. It's going to be on the air in a couple of weeks. Mitchell, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Traders reacted badly to that jobs report and some other stuff that we'll explain in about 20 seconds or so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. European markets had a troubled day today, and it wasn't just stocks either. Currency traders got in on the selling. The euro dropped to a four-year low against the dollar. There were two immediate reasons: fears about the Hungarian economy, of all places, and worries over the health of the French giant bank Société Générale. From the European desk in London Marketplaces, Stephen Beard reports.
The trouble began in Hungary. A leading member of the new government there made a speech about the country's public finances in language he may now regret. Here's analyst Christian Szabados speaking from Budapest.
He used the words that a politician cannot say in any circumstances. He said that Hungary is facing state bankruptcy.
Szabados says this allegation is unfounded and politically motivated. He claims the new government, which has only been in power for a week, is simply trying to wriggle out of its election promise to cut taxes.
And they have to explain it somehow, and they chose the worst tactics. They said that the country is in trouble.
If this was a ploy, it misfired. The Hungarian currency has plummeted, making it a lot more difficult for the government to borrow on international markets. Chris Hughes is with the financial website Breaking Views.
It's a very bizarre comment from the government, because it's like committing economic suicide. It's really going to worry the markets, and it has worried the markets.
European bank shares fell. French bank Société Générale shed almost 8%. Investors are aware the bank has lent heavily to Eastern Europe.
Where you have a specific problem to do with an Eastern European country like Hungary, investors are going to latch on to banks which might be heavily exposed to that.
Société Générale refused to comment. The Hungarian government is now trying to calm investor fears. Judging by today, European markets seem headed for a long, hot summer dominated by worries about debt and default. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If your investments went bad during the recession, you're out of luck, right? You can't really blame your bank or your investment advisor for what happened. Or can you? A jury in Minnesota says yes, indeed you can. They ruled today that Wells Fargo owes four nonprofits who trusted the bank to look after their money $30 million. Jurors said the bank stopped looking after its clients' best interests and started looking after its own, as Jeff Horwich reports.
Susan Lundy sat on the jury and listened to Wells Fargo's argument. The investment seemed safe at the time. They did their best to cope with a huge economic meltdown. But in testimony, she says bank executives seemed confused and out of touch with the complex investments they'd gotten into.
They sat up there and basically said things like, I didn't know we had a securities lending department. I didn't know what an SIV was. I had to look it up on Wikipedia. So I know it's a huge corporation, you know, but that didn't settle well with me.
Then came glimpses into the bank's internal panic as the market tanked. Emails that refer to the nonprofit clients as hostages that openly worry whether to tell them how bad things were.
When things fell apart, there were bad decisions that were made. And I think by sticking by those decisions, they did not adhere to their fiduciary duty.
Fiduciary duty, basically a legal term for putting your clients' interests first. The jury said Wells Fargo fell short, not least by letting some big investors get their money out while keeping small ones in the dark. In a statement, Wells Fargo says it's pleased with the small size of the damages. Plaintiffs wanted much more. But the verdict encourages lawyers like Terry Fruth, whose clients lost money in the same investment.
Wells Fargo finds itself in the position of the Philip Morris Tobacco Company. That is, it has been decided that this product is not safe and should be avoided by certain people.
Fruth says the jury did not find Wells Fargo was willfully trying to harm its clients. It just got in over its head. But now attorneys like Fruth know you can call that negligence, and it's good enough for $30 million. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
President Obama has clearly taken a wait-and-see approach to the oil leak in the Gulf. On a trip to Louisiana today, the president said that despite BP's newly installed top hat on the wellhead, it is way too early to be optimistic about anything. BP says it's collecting some oil from the leak. The Coast Guard puts it at about 1,000 barrels a day. Meanwhile, those live cams keep showing brownish goo spilling out into the water. Tar balls began washing ashore in Florida today. And politicians are scrambling to come up with ever more creative ways to punish BP. BP and the industry. Brett Neely reports now from Washington.
Life could get a lot tougher for BP in the oil industry. President Obama wants to end billions of dollars worth of tax breaks for oil exploration. Many in Congress want to scrap the $75 million liability cap per oil spill. And one congressman wants BP to pay royalties on the spilled oil, just like it does on oil they sell. But none of this is punishment, says Dan Weiss at the Liberal Center for American Progress.
It's making sure that BP and other similar oil companies pay for the damages they cause.
Weiss wants the government to collect enough money to cover those damages. He says BP is on track to make $20 billion this year, so it wouldn't hurt the company to put its first quarter profit of $5 billion into a special fund to compensate victims of the spill.
We're not talking about harming a mom-and-pop grocery store. These oil companies are some of the largest companies in America.
Norm Ornstein is at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. He says some of the proposals are just posturing, but Congress is looking for money anywhere it can find it.
Let's face it, one of the things going on here is that it's not an easy thing at this time to talk about tax increases. That's a toxic element in our political dialogue. But it's a lot easier to talk about squeezing taxes out of oil companies right now.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid now says he plans to fast-track a new climate and energy bill. Ornstein thinks the longer the leak continues, the tougher the legislation could end up being. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Shares of BP didn't survive the sell-off on Wall Street today. They fell another 5% in New York. It's been a tough week. Two major ratings agencies downgraded BP's creditworthiness a couple of days ago. The running tab for the cleanup is at $1 billion and counting. And there is no small amount of speculation that if things keep going, BP is going to find itself in some financial trouble. With that as background, here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine, also Heidi Moore from The Big Money. Good to talk to you both again.
Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Heidi, we will start with you and the company formerly known as British Petroleum. We did a little bit earlier this week on the broadcast about, you know, whether this company can survive given the way things are going. What's your take? I mean, is it all doom and gloom now, corporate-wise?
It can survive, unfortunately, given the scale of what they have perpetrated upon the American environment. The interesting thing about BP is how completely immense they are. And if you actually take a look at what it would cost to clean up everything that's going on, the estimate is somewhere between $4 billion and $30 billion. BP makes usually somewhere around $20 billion a year in profit, just pure profit, not even revenue. So it would take so much money to wipe out this company. And unfortunately, this oil spill is probably not going to get them there, despite the fact that it's going to devastate a huge section of the American economy.
Megan, what do you think?
I agree with Heidi. I think the cost that there is going to be imposed on them is nowhere near the cost to the American public. You know, they've got like $250 billion in assets. This company is not going to be taken down by this oil spill. I guess whether you think that's a sad thing or a great thing depends on how much BP stock you own.
So speculation then, Heidi, about BP being a takeover target and mergers and all that stuff, you're not buying it?
I don't really think so. Right now, we've seen BP stock price taken down 33% by the market. If this continues, it'll probably be taken down more. And any other company would be really unintelligent to pay that high a price for the company until it's really in full-on distress. So even if they take them out at this price, it's probably not as low as the price they could pay later on. And then they'd also have to take on the huge risk of litigation and potentially civil fines as well. So I don't know any oil company that's willing to do all that.
Yeah. The president finds himself today on the Gulf Coast for the third time. He's canceled that trip to Asia for the second time because of this spill. Megan, what is this going to do to the rest of his domestic agenda? I don't want to get too far into the whole, you know, the president is completely sunk because of this, but it is affecting what he can do.
You know, I think that what Obama is witnessing is what a friend of mine calls the Care Bear Stare model of American politics. Where,
okay, enlighten us, because I have no idea what that means.
Well, the Care Bears had this special Care Bear stare that if you just cared hard enough would fix basically any problem. And I think that that's ultimately what
wow.
people are now accusing Obama of, right? Is no one thinks that he can, like, do a Bill Pullman and pilot a secret sub down to the ocean floor.
From Independence Day, right? The hero president from Independence Day, right?
And fix it himself. But people seem to wish he were panicking harder or being meaner to BP or in some way make them feel like he was really upset. And so I guess what we really need is a great national carer in chief. But I mean, it is hurting him. I think that you're seeing it in his poll ratings, and that in some ways, like Katrina, you know, by the time everything went wrong in Katrina, Bush himself had basically no power to fix anything.
Right.
But we fix these things on the guy who happens to be kind of standing around in the Oval Office when things go wrong. And, you know, for good or ill, Obama has certainly used that in his favor, in blaming everything that he could on the Republicans and, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword.
And here it goes, yeah. Heidi, what about things like the financial reform bill? Nobody's talking about that now. It's all oil all the time.
That's true, to which I'm sure a number of people on Wall Street are grateful to BP.
That's right.
If not for the actual performance of BP stock. But I think that's still an issue that's pending, but it's going to be pending probably until July 4th. And we have time to think about that. In the meantime, the BP oil spill is kind of at crisis levels. And so our attention kind of goes towards the shinier issue always. And this definitely deserves to be the shinier issue right now.
Heidi Moore, she writes for The Big Money. Megan McArdle from The Atlantic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Pat.
Coming up, a picture is worth a thousand bites.
This wonderful woman from Dallas came in last week, and she is gluten-free. And the only reason that she knew about us is because she typed in gluten-free Seattle. And up came this picture that somebody had taken.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors spent the day second-guessing whether Wall Street's been overly optimistic. The answer is a resounding yes on this Friday. The Dow Industrials set back 323 points, slightly more than 3%, wrapped up the trading week well below the 10,000 mark. The blue chips came to rest at 9,931. NASDAQ shed 83 points, nearly 3 2/3%, finished at 2219. The S&P 500 retreated 37 points, almost 3.5%, 1,064. For the opening week of June, the Dow down 2%. The NASDAQ gave back 1.7%. The S&P 500 lost 2.3% since traders came back from the holiday on Tuesday. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its monthly consumer credit report. A House Energy and Commerce subcommittee holds a hearing in Louisiana on the local impact of the oil spill. And does your head hurt? Then this is for you. It's National Headache Awareness Week. Hope you feel better. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace on a Friday afternoon from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You have probably witnessed some version of this scene in the supermarket. Child enters cereal aisle, grabs tastiest looking thing he can. Parents start saying no. Child pulls box off shelf and refuses to let go. Enter now the It's Good For You health claim, the cereal box that says on the front, it will make your kid smarter or stronger. The advertising that sometimes pushes parents across that line from no to not no. Today, the Federal Trade Commission, for the second time, told Kellogg's to cut it out, that they can't say Rice Krispies boosts kids' immunities.
From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
The television ad features a very, very cute four-year-old listening to her first bowl of Rice Krispies. Well, we hear.
Now, every box of Kellogg's Rice Krispies cereal has antioxidants and nutrients that help support your child's immune system.
This immunity claim hit the airwaves just when fear over swine flu was at its peak. It's the second Kellogg's ad that the FTC has tagged as misleading. The first was when the company claimed that frosted mini wheats were clinically shown to improve kids' attentiveness by 20%. The control group in that study? Kids who got a breakfast of only water. Jennifer Pomerantz of the Yale Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity says it's not just Kellogg's.
Nestle's Juicy Juice has an immunity claim. It also has a claim that the Juicy Juice can give children brain development. These are claims that seem to be unsubstantiated.
But they make food sell better.
Ironically, the more unhealthy cereals had more health claims on them, actually.
Kellogg said today it will drop its immunity claim from Rice Krispies ads. Dennis Herrera is city attorney of San Francisco. He's been pushing for greater scrutiny of food advertising. He calls the FTC announcement
an extremely good step, that it shows that the FTC is getting back into its traditional role of making sure that it is the regulator.
But when it comes to health claims, the FTC is just the watchdog. Now the Food and Drug Administration is considering whether it should apply the same rules to food health claims as it does to drugs. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The blogosphere offers opinions, lots of them. What to buy, what not to buy, what to wear, what not to wear, and increasingly what to eat or not to eat. Food blogs and review sites are everywhere online today, leading to behavior at restaurants that would probably have Emily Post rolling over in her grave. From New York, Sally Herships has more.
It's Thursday night. I'm at Fatty Q, a trendy barbecue joint in Brooklyn. I'm here with Hagen Blount, Lawrence Weibman, and Andy Friedman. Three big, hungry guys trying to decide what to get for dinner.
The crab laksa, the spare ribs, and the brisket.
They spend a while debating their order.
I would be interested in the cucumbers.
But when the food finally comes, no one touches it. Instead of attacking their plates, they're photographing them, which isn't easy because it's kind of dark in here.
Have you been using the 2-second delay?
1 second.
Yeah, 1 second delay.
Ever since you told me it's unkitchy.
Hagen, Blount, and Weibman are going to post the photos online, along with a review of the restaurant. That's because they're food bloggers, or, depending on who you ask, food paparazzi. And Weibman's not very fond of the term.
The idea of paparazzi definitely has a negative connotation to it, almost like, you know, a shoe fly. And what we're doing here, me, is out of passion. We love food.
But whether you call them paparazzi or bloggers, they're showing up in restaurants more often, bringing cameras and sometimes even tripods along with their appetite. Like at Cafe Flora, a vegetarian restaurant in Seattle. Nat Stratton Clark is the owner. For the most part, he's very happy with the free publicity.
This wonderful woman from Dallas came in last week, and she is gluten-free. And the only reason that she knew about us is because she typed in gluten-free Seattle. And up came this picture that somebody had taken.
But sometimes the quality of the photos doesn't match the quality of the food. They can be underexposed or taken mid-meal, bite marks and all. Katie Greco is VP of Operations and New Projects at Kraft Restaurants in New York. We sat down to take a look at some of the pictures bloggers have posted of three-star meals from celebrity chef Tom Colicchio.
I think they're horrible looking, aren't they? I mean, you tell me, but like if I were to look at that picture, I wouldn't think that looks particularly appetizing. And that was a good review.
But Greco isn't that concerned with the pictures themselves. Instead, she says, the bigger problem is the possibility of bloggers disrupting the ambiance with flashes or tripods and disturbing diners trying to enjoy their meals in peace. The average check at Kraft is about $100.
When people are playing a high price tag, the expectations are often just as high, if not higher.
Trendy eateries like New York City's Momofuku Co. and Le Caprice have banned photography altogether, and Kraft doesn't allow photographers to use a flash. But Greco's biggest beef with bloggers is their potential lack of experience. She doesn't want amateur food writers influencing people's dining decisions.
When you feel like they're having that influence without really knowing what they're talking about. It's very frustrating.
Back at Fatty Q, food blogger Lawrence Weibman tells me he understands. Sort of.
But in the end, if a chef is making good food, he or she has nothing to worry about because it speaks for itself.
You know that old saying, everyone's a critic? Well, for restaurant owners, it's truer than ever. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
How is it?
Delicious. That is some pretty awesome pork goodness right there, I'm telling you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which we will take a break from the actual news of the week and fill you in on the things that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Fatty Hirsch, senior editor for Marketplace. What's your story?
Iceland.
Oh, here we go again.
You know, obviously, they've been having problems with, you know, bank crises and volcanoes and stuff. Now they're trying to rehabilitate their tarnished public image with an email campaign, of all things.
Explain.
So the manager of tourism in Iceland asked Icelanders all around the world to email everybody that they knew a message of love about Iceland and what a great place it is.
Wait, so let me get this straight. They're using spam to make themselves more popular? Way to go.
It's ironic, I admit.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What's your story this weekend?
Facebook and privacy. I mean, we're all talking about it.
It's the same old story.
Oh, yeah, except this time, the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, he was speaking at a big tech conference, and he says that Facebook's taking privacy and the privacy issues that are out there really seriously, because even he, when he was young, he's done some stupid things that he doesn't want on the internet.
When he was young? Mm-hmm. How old is Mark Zuckerberg?
This guy's 26.
I guess, you know, every $10 million you have is like another 4 years of experience.
Yeah.
It's like dog years. It's millionaire years. Adrian Hill, sustainability reporter for Marketplace. What's your story this weekend?
This week I'm going to go with Dawn soap.
Why?
Because Dawn is getting a lot of attention for cleaning off oil-covered seabirds. And I actually found this advertisement online that shows this cute little duckling covered in what looks like oil getting washed off. I called them up and I said, like, you didn't actually cover this cute little duckling in oil, did you?
Yeah.
No, molasses and finger paint makes good television oil on duck.
If you add molasses with 5-star spices and ginger, now you're talking.
Yeah,
you're
there's talking. A dish. There's a dish. The finger paint you are going to want to leave out of the recipe.
There is more just like that on Brendan and Rico's podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. There is, of course, a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. Rico's on his honeymoon, by the way, back in a couple of weeks. That is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 323 points, a little more than 3%. The NASDAQ dropped 83 points, 3.67%. S&P 500 lost 37 points, nearly 3.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a money writer in money trouble.
I looked at him and I said, you must be kidding. I'm a personal finance disaster. I mean, how could I possibly take this job?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a good weekend. We will see you on Monday.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.